We come now to chapter 2, verse 16. All through this letter, Paul is concerned with a group of people who are scoffing at some of the simple practices that some of the community have. Every culture has different ways of giving expression to its religious experience, and these are laughing at these practices and trying to win people away into an esoteric, star-worshipping community that has special knowledge and special insight that the rest don't have. And so Paul says in verse 16, "Don't let anyone condemn you in matters of food and drink, or in matters of observing festivals, new moons, or Sabbaths." Some of the practices that probably particularly the Jewish minority in the community were used to practicing and were continuing in their Christian life. Paul goes on, all that concerns him is as long as they realise, as he says, these are only a shadow of what is to come. Paul doesn't condemn them in any way, but they're only a shadow of what is to come. The substance belongs to the Messiah. So he goes on, don't let anyone disqualify you, insisting on, inverted commas, humility and worship of angels, dwelling on visions puffed up without cause by a human way of thinking. Don't let anyone disqualify you for that, and not holding fast to the head, from whom the whole body, nourished and held together by its ligaments and sinews, grows with a growth that is from God. Here Paul takes us to the heart of the problem disturbing the community at Colossae. They're being tempted to strive for humility. I'll talk about that in a moment. They're desirous of having visions. They want the experience of joining in the worship offered to God by angels. However, what's actually happening is that they're being puffed up with pride. The problem, says Paul, repeating an earlier statement, is that they're caught up in a human way of thinking. They fail to grasp what humility is as a Christian virtue. By turning aside from Jesus, the head, and the source of coordination and growth in his body, they are undermining communion. So Paul goes on in verse 20, if with the Messiah you died to the principles of the world, why do you live as if you still belonged to the world? Why do you submit to regulations? Don't handle, don't taste, don't touch. All these regulations refer to things that perish with use. They're simply human commands and teachings. These have indeed an appearance of wisdom in promoting self-imposed piety, humility, and severe treatment of the body, but they're of no value in checking self-indulgence. In baptism, we died to our past way of life, in which we followed principles that belonged to this world only. Now we are living Jesus' life. Why submit again to regulations that are based on principles that have their origin in worldly thinking, but are unrelated to Jesus? These are no more than human commands and teachings. Self-motivated asceticism is unable to check self-centered behaviour. we must look to Jesus. If we truly live his life, what is not of him will be crucified. We are to have faith in the power of God. Only activity inspired by the risen Jesus and flowing from our being made alive together with him can make for peace. Christianity is about ordinary, real, human experience. It's about the pain and fidelity of Jesus' love. It's about our struggle personally and as a community against the sin that clings to us and distracts us. It's about being instruments of God's love in this world. Paul is reminding us of this and drawing us back to Jesus, lest our lives be spent in social, political, theological, and personal distraction, and our contribution to the world be empty, because unredeemed by his love and vitiated by pride. Let's now, Paul's used the word humility twice, but in a negative sense. Let's spend some moments now looking at the Christian virtue of humility. I'll give you the Greek because it's important. Tapeno phrosune. Phrosune comes from the Greek phren. It means a way of thinking. And tapenos means lowly, as distinct from up. It's thinking of oneself as being low. Now, being low has no value in itself, but it does attract God's compassionate love, and it does hold out hope for redemption. The following text from Isaiah is typical. Sing for joy, O heavens, and exult, O earth. Break forth, O mountains, into singing, for the Lord has comforted his people and will have compassion on his lowly ones. Tapenos. Sirach recommends lowering oneself before God. I'll read to you from chapter 2. They who fear the Lord keep their hearts prepared and bow down their souls in his presence. Greek moral philosophy outside the Bible has no place for thinking of oneself as low, tapeno phrosune, humility. The word doesn't occur prior to Paul. It seems that he created the word to talk about something amazingly central that's Christian. Shortly after Paul's time, we do find the word being used by Plutarch, Epictetus, and Josephus. But it's always a vice. It's never a virtue. As they use the word, it's best translated small-minded or mean-spirited. It's equivalent to having a low self-esteem. That's in the Greek world. In the Greek Old Testament, the related adjective occurs only once. It's in the book of Proverbs. Is chapter 29, verse 23, where the author writes, "A person's pride will bring humiliation, but one who is lowly in spirit, there's our word, humility, will obtain honour. The related verb also occurs only once in the Greek Old Testament, in Psalm 131, which prepares us for its use in the New Testament. The psalm reads, O Lord, my heart is not lifted up, my eyes are not raised too high. I do not occupy myself with things too great and too marvellous for me, but I've calmed and quieted my soul. It's there, I've calmed, that's from the Hebrew. The Greek text reads, I think of myself humbly. There's our word again. The verb, not the noun, humility. That hasn't occurred yet, but the adjective has, and so has the verb. And the psalm continues, I'm like a weaned child with its mother. My soul is like the weaned child that is with me. O Israel, hope in the Lord from this time onward and evermore. The following scene from the Gospel recalls Psalm 131. I'm reading from Matthew chapter 18. The disciples came to Jesus and asked, who is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Jesus called a child, whom he put among them and said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become little children, you'll never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever becomes lowly like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. So the little child is offered as a symbol of humility, for it beautifully captures Jesus' own childlike trust in the God whom he calls Abba, Father. Jesus wants his disciples to have a heart that's humble like his. Learn from me, for I'm gentle and humble in heart. Because Jesus looked up to God in loving trust, he was able to look up to everyone, delighting in people with the delight that belongs to the innocence of childhood, and experiencing it as a privilege to serve them. All this provides the background to the virtue which appears for the first time in Greek in Paul. Humility, that is, thinking of oneself as low, is an attitude of mind and heart that recognizes oneself as God's child, sharing the life of his Son, and therefore living in total dependence on God. The humble person delights in this dependence, knowing that God is a Father and can be absolutely counted on as a source of life, love and hope. No wonder the Greek world didn't have anything to do with humility. The self held a central place in the ethics of the Greek and Roman moralists. They thought of their individual nature as sharing in the divinity. The divine in each person was thought of as identified with the self. It was important, therefore, to recognize and respect oneself and not to think of oneself in a servile way. For the Christian, the divine spirit which sanctifies the self is not identical with it. It's the spirit of Jesus. As Paul writes, it's no longer I who live, it's the Messiah who lives in me. To know how to obey the divine will, Christians don't look to their own nature and strive to act accordingly. Rather, they listen attentively to the call of the Lord and strive to be obedient to one in whose wisdom and love they trust. The highest freedom experienced by disciples of Jesus is to be his slave, to allow him to live in them and to find in the freedom given by Jesus an opportunity to be, through love, slaves of one another. I'm reading from Galatians chapter 5. Christians experience a radical and liberating change of perspective. If anyone, says Paul to the Corinthians, if anyone's in the Messiah, there's a new creation. In this new creature, humility is a basic virtue. Everything now is possible, not to the one who is most self-sufficient, but, as Jesus says in Mark chapter 9, for one who believes. The self is no less important, but perfection for the self is a flowering of the gifts of the Spirit, and the way to this perfection is in self-giving after the example of Jesus and by the power of Jesus' Spirit. Those who try to make their life, he said, will lose it. It's those who lose their life who'll keep it. Those who give their life away will gain it. Humility as a Christian virtue is a sharing in the life of Jesus, the child of God, and in the intimacy of his trust in the Father. Paul believes that it is Jesus who's living in him and in the Christians to whom he's writing. He wants them to let this special trusting dependence of Jesus on his Father find expression in their lives too. Then they would have no difficulty in looking up to others, delighting in their gifts and looking after their interests. Humility for a disciple of Jesus has nothing to do with belittling self or, as in Colossians, abasing themselves before the angelic powers. Humility is the recognition of oneself as a child of God and is a trust that oneself will be created by God's love. So with no occurrences in Greek prior to Paul, and with only two verses in the Greek Old Testament translation that reach towards this word humility, Paul's the first person to use it because he has Jesus surprising a new virtue, a virtue that you don't find anywhere. It's the virtue in Jesus of his being humble. child of God, thinking of himself as low, not great or high, but as a lowly child, perfectly confident in a father's love. It's a beautiful virtue, and perhaps more rare than we'd like to hope. Now we come to chapter 3 in Colossians. Paul writes, "If you've been raised with the Messiah, seek the things that are above, where he is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you've died, and your life is hidden with the Messiah in God. When he who is your life is revealed, then you also will be revealed with him in glory." Paul has already written earlier in the letter, "As you have received the Messiah, Jesus the Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him. For in him the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily, and you've come to fullness in him. When you were buried with him in baptism, you were also raised with him." Since God has raised us from the dead, and since the life we're living is a sharing in the risen life of Jesus, we should look to him and seek from him the graces which he offers us from his position as Lord seated at the right hand of God. God now exercises God's power, the redeeming power of God's love, through the anointed Messiah. If we're truly to live in a life of communion with the risen Jesus, we mustn't set our hearts and fix our thoughts on the things of earth. Rather, we must look to him, be attentive to his word, and be ready to carry out his will. Things, as Paul has already said, were once different. But he's rescued us from the power of darkness. That's chapter 1, verse 13. And in him, the following verse, we've received redemption, the forgiveness of our sins. We who were once estranged and hostile in mind, he has now reconciled. The record of our guilt has been set aside, nailed to the cross. Our sinful past was buried with Jesus when we were welcomed into the community of believers in baptism and when we began a new life. As Paul said in his Galatian letter, "I've been crucified with Jesus. It's no longer I who live. It's the Messiah who is living in me." And in Romans, Paul writes, "How can we who died to sin go on living in it? But if we have died with the Messiah, we believe that we'll also live with him." That's chapter 6. Chapter 7 of Romans, "You died so that you may belong to another, to him who has been raised from the dead, in order that we may bear fruit for God." This is a matter of faith. Jesus has not yet appeared in glory, and it's not yet fully apparent that we're living his life. In this sense, we are, as Paul has already said, we're hidden with the Messiah in God. But it will be made apparent. And in this hope, we are to live the new life with which we have been graced. And Paul goes on in verse 5. Put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly. Fornication, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming on those who are disobedient. These are the ways you also once followed when you were living that life. But now you must get rid of all such things. Wrath, explosions of anger, malice, slander, abusive language from your mouth, and don't lie to one another. In the previous passage, Paul laid down general principles that should guide the Colossians in living a life that's possible and fitting for them as baptized Christians. In the words we just read, Paul now describes the kind of life they were living, the kind of life which died and was buried in baptism, and to which they mustn't return. Similar lists of immoral behaviour can be found in Paul's earlier letters. You might like to read Galatians 5:19 and the first letter to the Thessalonians chapter 4. Though parallels can be found in the Stoic moral manuals of the day, Paul is mainly reproducing the kind of list we find in descriptions of behaviour judged by Jews to be typical of Gentiles. He is, in effect, saying to the Gentile Christians of Colossae, don't return to the kind of life you lived before your conversion to Jesus. Let's look at 5 again. Put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly. And he lists fornication, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed. The list begins with fornication, porneia, a word covering a whole range of morally irresponsible behaviour in matters of sexuality. He puts it first because the way we relate sexually is central to who we are and to the way we express or fail to express love. He then goes on to speak of impurity, the pollution of our physical environment bears no comparison with the harm caused when we pollute the mind and heart. And so Paul goes on to name the vice of passion. He's thinking of inordinate passion. The sin translated here as greed refers to an aggressive ruthlessness which also finds expression in the area of sexuality. Being a Christian means living in a certain way. It concerns the truth of who we are as persons. It's not surprising, therefore, that Paul moves immediately to speak of sexuality. For where else do all the dimensions of being human meet more intimately and more mysteriously than in our identity as man or woman. It's traditional Jewish and Christian wisdom that sexual relationships are meant to be sacraments in which we encounter the divine at the heart of another person cherished in love. There are divinely mysterious depths in every person. Sexual experience invites us into this mystery in which two people enjoy, encourage, heal, forgive, and create each other in loving trust. There's a restlessness and a mysterious yearning at the heart of sexuality, for we know that we're not sufficient of ourselves. We need the other. We long to be in communion with the other. It's common human wisdom born of experience that when we give expression to our sexual desire, we should do so in a way that recognizes the sacredness and the dignity of our own person and of the other. Paul is speaking here of sexual behavior which ignores all delicacy, which bypasses love, and uses, even abuses, another person in a selfish attempt to assert one's own power or gratify one's own, what he calls, evil desire.